I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday Friday. In this hour, we catch up on the news of the week, including the mayor's call for more black men to mentor boys as a way of stemming violence in Baltimore. We'll get a report from Annapolis on the General Assembly's budget wrangling. We'll hear about millennials and healthcare and women's basketball. Joan Jacobson joins us. She authored a study for the Able Foundation on the city's controversial tax sale practices. That report sparked a reform effort to protect elderly and low-income homeowners who risk losing their houses while owing as little as $250 in property taxes. Plus, we have the Midday Business Report from Sarah Gantz of the Baltimore Business Journal, and WYPR Sports at Large commentator Milton Kent scouts out the Terps women as they head into the Sweet 16. It's Midday Friday after the news. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here. Thanks again for joining us. In this first hour of the show, we'll talk about some important issues of the week. A call from City Hall from Mayor Stephanie Rawlings Blake for more black men to mentor boys as a way of stemming violence in Baltimore City. Passage of a new state budget in Annapolis. And an update on the controversial practice of city tax sales. Joan Jacobson will be joining us in a few minutes. She wrote a report for the Able Foundation last fall about city tax sales. There's an effort in the General Assembly to protect homeowners who can lose and have lost their properties for owing as little as $250 in back taxes. We'll talk about that reform effort today. Milton Kent will be joining us, Sports at Large commentator, to talk about the University of Maryland women's basketball team as they head into the Sweet 16 this weekend. We start the show with Chris Connolly, WYPR legislative reporter who's in Annapolis, just to get an update from him on what's been going on in the legislature. Chris, thanks for joining us. How you doing?
I'm doing well.
Oh, you doing well. Okay, good. It's Christopher Connolly. So, Chris, we've got a budget passed by the Maryland Senate. And it's $40.7 billion, and I'm looking at it here. I'm wondering, what's the big news here? The governor, Larry Hogan, put in some cuts. It looks like legislators were able to avoid or restore a lot of the money that was proposed as for cuts.
They did, yeah. I mean, the biggest concern, I think, was over Hogan put less money into education than a lot of the Democrats wanted to see, to the tune of about $144 million. Almost all of that is back in this budget after the House and then the Senate went to work on it. Mm-hmm. They also restored a cost of living increase for state workers and put more money in for safety net programs, mental health care, support for people who work with people with developmental disabilities. And you really sort of saw this overwhelming support for the budget. It passed unanimously in the Senate, which hasn't happened since back in the Ehrlich years, and passed, I think, only 10 delegates voted against it out of 141 in the House. So it really seems to be a big hit.
Okay, it seems to be a big hit, but I'm wondering, okay, is this a sign of bipartisan cooperation? Because they did away with most of the governor's cuts to the education formulas, and you just mentioned the state workers are going to get a cost of living raise, 2%. The governor had proposed rescinding that. So how does the governor feel about this budget?
He has said, you know, that he is happy with it for the most part. There's some things that give him pause. He's not thrilled with the fact that it doesn't close the state structural deficit entirely. It gets 75% of the state's structural deficit out of the way this year and then plans to get the rest of it next year. And the other piece that seems to be giving him a little bit of heartburn is a change to the way that we're funding pensions and the amount that we're funding pensions this year. Mm-hmm. We're putting less into the pension fund this year, and that's to sort of make up some of the money that they wanted to put back into education and such. But, I mean, I do think that it is a sign that, you know, the Republican governor and the Democratic legislature are able to work together. You know, there's a lot of talk of bipartisanship early in the session. That seemed to hit some rough patches early on, but it seems to be back on track now. And you even had Senate President Mike Miller say, you know, listen, the governor has worked with us to help us restore some of our priorities in the budget, so we're now going to work with him to get some of his legislative agenda done. So I think that bipartisanship to a degree seems to be back on track.
Okay. Chris, now we've got a few weeks, maybe two and a half weeks until sine die, the end of the session.
Uh-huh.
What is it, April 9th, right?
April 14th.
Oh, I'm sorry, April 14th. So, okay, still two or three weeks away. What do you see on the horizon? What remains to be done?
Well, so you had a huge flurry of activity early this week coming up to what we call crossover day down here. That's when, under the normal order, bills are supposed to be passed in their own chamber so that they can move to the opposite chamber, you know, and sort of in an orderly way go through the committees and then get passage there and get the kinks worked out. And so you had a ton of bills that passed in each house earlier today. So what you have now is the committees in the House and the committees in the Senate taking a look at the stuff that sort of wound up on their plate. So they're kind of sorting through a whole deluge of bills, and so we're going to sort of see that sort out. The budget has to go now to a conference committee. There are some slight differences between the House and the Senate version, but really, I mean, I think the differences are much smaller than we've seen in previous years. So, I mean, that may not be a sort of up to the last minute debate, but you know, you get this thing that happens at this point where sort of you're starting to see which things are going to go, which things are not, and which things are going to keep everybody up late on the last day of session, trying to come to some kind of compromise between the two chambers.
So you're not expecting to see any major controversial bill, long debate, filibuster, anything like that coming up in the next 2 or 3 weeks?
Well, there'll be long debate on some of them. Both chambers, for example, passed fracking legislation that do totally different things. One is a moratorium that passed the House. It's a 3-year moratorium. The other one puts really tough liabilities that passed the Senate. You saw tons of debate this week on both of those. When they switch over to the other chamber for consideration, I imagine you're going to see a lot of debate there. Mm-hmm. There's a bill that deals with hotel taxes for online travel agents like Expedia and such that passed the Senate. That's going to move over to the House. Any bill that you know looks like a tax increase, there's a question about whether or not it's actually a tax increase, but looks like a tax increase to many, that'll have a lot of debate around it. But not a lot of the sort of huge, you know, things that you had back when there was discussion about, you know, repealing the death penalty or gay marriage or these big hallmark issues.
Right.
They will find things to have long debates about and get to fight about.
All right, Chris. Thanks for that report.
Sure thing.
Thank you very much. Christopher Connolly, who covers the General Assembly for WYPR. We switch now to P. Kenneth Burns, who covers City Hall, among other things, for WYPR. Nice to see you, Ken.
Thank you, Daniel.
You were out at Empowerment Temple this week. I think it was Tuesday night.
Yes.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake following up on the call-out she had made in her State of the City address, calling for more black men to step up, mentor boys and young men in Baltimore City as a way of stemming violence in Baltimore.
Yes, this call took place at Empowerment Temple, as you mentioned, and it was a good turnout. Can't really say if off the top of my head if the church was full, but you have people who actually heeded the call from the mayor, and it should be noted that the mayor, during her introduction to the forum, she made it clear she was not blaming black men at all. She just said that we have to do more and reach into the lives of young children.
She answered a complaint right off the bat.
Yes.
Some people have said, you know, the mayor's throwing, there was a letter to the editor in The Sun that said mayor's throwing black men under the bus, blaming them for violence in the city.
Yes, and she also answered another complaint in the press conference that took place before the event. I don't know if you recall my story a couple of weeks ago, but the Reverend C.D. Witherspoon from the Southern Christian Leadership Conference Baltimore City chapter, he had that one complaint that he felt that the mayor was blaming black men, but he also said she didn't have the understanding of how crime works overall, let alone black crime, citing that Baltimore is a majority black city. She also answered another complaint about is this more the same? Is this just going to be another talk where we talk about the issue and nothing comes from it? She made it clear that this was about action.
Okay, so there's a lot of men in the audience. I think the Sun estimated there were about 1,000 people there.
Yeah.
Okay. Was there a sign-up sheet at the end of the night? What did the other speakers say? Did they call for men to actually stand up and volunteer?
Well, Pastor Brian called for at least 20 men to sign up as mentors. The city has a waiting list of 900 children, boys and girls, just waiting for a mentor. In the lobby of the church, you had several organizations ready and willing to sign men up, Big Brothers, Big Sisters. There was an organization called GOSO, that's short for Get Out and Stay Out, and was started by two men who had a troubled past but turned their lives together, and they're reaching back, trying to reach out to young people. Mm-hmm. And there were also services for people looking for help themselves, like the Recovery Network.
So the men who showed up, and there were a lot of them, are responding to this message.
They are. A couple of them that I spoke with, they didn't feel that the mayor was insulting black men. And one guy in particular, he saw that it was a great first step, and he's looking forward to getting his hands dirty.
Did the police have any presence there? Was the police commissioner there or any
The police commissioner was there. Lieutenant Colonel Melvin Russell, who is long known as a hands-on commander helping the community. He was there along with Lieutenant Colonel Melissa Hyatt. So you had police leadership there. Don Fry from Greater Baltimore Committee was in the audience. And I can't remember which panelists asked Don Fry to look into how GBC could help, but they asked them to help out as well.
Hmm. It's interesting because the violent crime is down. I mean, the homicides are still up over 200 in Baltimore City, but generally violent crime has been coming down. It's interesting the mayor makes this call now. Of course, she is the mayor now. So, but, you know, it's a call out that probably should have gone out years ago for more people to be involved in mentoring kids.
It probably should have gone out years ago. Why that call wasn't made,
there
no
were
one
efforts.
Knows.
Baltimore Rising was one of them. There have been right. efforts been made, but this is directly from the mayor's bully pulpit.
Right, and one of the panelists is Munir Bahar, who you know started the 300-man movement not too long ago. He impressed upon the crowd, I didn't wait for the mayor to make the call. I stepped up, and if I could do it, you could do it.
Yeah. All right, Kenny, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Dan.
Kenneth Burns, who covers City Hall for WYPR. I turn now to Joan Jacobson, who's in the studio with us again. Joan, nice to see you.
Thanks for having me, Dan.
Joan Jacobson, longtime reporter of the Baltimore Sun, has been working on a freelance basis doing reports for the Able Foundation for Able Reports. And the last time you were on the show was October last year. And we were talking about the report you did on city tax sales.
Right.
Now, we're going to take a break in a couple of minutes. But I think in those 2 minutes, we ought to just start off by describing to people, to our listeners, what this is. What's a city tax sale?
It's a very complicated process. But any property owner in Baltimore City who doesn't pay taxes or water bills or some other fees can lose their house or lose their property. The city can sell the lien that's owed on that property at auction. They do it every May, I believe. And once that's sold, the owner, the purchaser of the lien, has a certain amount of time to file foreclosure and take control of the property. In the meantime, in this case, the homeowner has a chance to redeem the property, but at 18% interest. And the homeowner has to also pay legal fees and court costs. It can be so expensive that a $500 tax bill redeemed 2 years later grows to $2,000.
Wow. Okay. So,
$3,000.
$3,000.
Yeah.
And the threshold in Baltimore City for
yes.
this whole thing
right.
to sort of trigger
yes.
is only $250.
That is correct. It's $250 for taxes. It's $350 for water bills. And so what happened is a group of excellent housing counselors and advocates and lawyers got together a year before my study and formed a tax sale foreclosure work group. and came up with lots of ideas for changing the system to help homeowners, especially low-income homeowners, seniors.
And seniors, right?
Yes. And then the APLE Foundation hired me to do the report.
All right. Some more on that report after our break, Joan. And we can talk about this reform that's come out of this work group that's been in Annapolis trying to change this system. So more with Joan Jacobson here on Midday Friday. After a short break, we continue our conversation. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Dan Rodericks here, speaking with Joan Jacobson, author of a 2014 ABLE Foundation report on the city's tax sale system. You could call it draconian tax sale system because for as little as $250 in arrears in taxes, a homeowner in Baltimore City can actually lose their home. And there's an effort in Annapolis to reform this system, do something about it, to better protect low-income, especially low-income and elderly homeowners in Baltimore. So, Joan, I just want to give a scenario to our listeners here. Say an elderly person owns a row house in Highland Town someplace, East Baltimore. They owe $450. What? They don't know they owe. They can't afford it. They can't read their tax bill. What happens?
There's a lot of scenarios here. I'm going to use the example of a $500 bill.
Okay.
Because I used that example when I met with the city finance people. But there can be many reasons. Obviously, sometimes people don't have the money. Sometimes people don't understand the bill. Sometimes the bill payer in the house has died or is very sick. And whoever it remains, the wife or husband, can't understand what to do when. And what's called the lien on the house is sold at a tax sale every May.
One question before you go on. How long are you in delinquency before your property comes up in a tax sale?
Less than a year. I believe your tax bills are due in the spring and then in the fall. So, you know, in less than a year.
Okay.
It's for the year.
Okay.
And there is no difference in the law between and how it treats homeowners versus other property owners. It's all the same, and that's where we're going to talk in a few minutes about how the bill is going to hopefully change that.
So a tax sale, somebody who wants to grab one of these properties
right.
makes a bid,
right.
correct?
Right. And they get the property, and the owner of the property still has time to redeem it up to possibly as long as 2 years until the purchaser of the lien files foreclosure in court to take control of the property.
Okay.
But during that time, the 18% interest is collecting. And so our court costs and legal fees mounting. And when I did the study for ABLE, I had the city finance department tell me after 2 years, say I finally want to get some money and redeem my house.
And you had a $500
bill. Tax bill. Mm-hmm. I would have to pay $3,000.
Okay, that's where that figure came from earlier. Okay.
Right, that's the interest, the court costs, the legal fees, postage, everything. So, and currently there is no way to pay that other than a lump sum.
Okay, if you actually pay the lump sum off, does the person who purchased or the company that purchased this lien have to honor that? They have to.
Have to, yes.
They have to.
Yeah.
So you. Under law, you can redeem your
yes.
property if you do all of that.
Right.
Okay. So I think one of the problems here seems to be the threshold, the $250 trigger.
Right.
So tell us about the work group that's been working on tax sales and has gone to Annapolis to seek
right.
reforms.
Right. Well, so this is a story about how everybody came together and started doing the right thing. So this work group is made up of really wonderful, smart housing advocates from neighborhood housing services and pro bono legal services and community law center and all kinds of groups. And they started working on this. And then ABLE was part of it, too. They brought me in. I did the study. I wrote a long list of recommendations. Some were mine. Some were ABLE. Some were the tax sale work group. They went to work with legislators. In the meantime, the city stepped up to the plate. And the city's lobbyist, Mary Pat Fannin, and the finance director, Henry Raymond, really pushed this legislation to change parts of the law. Now, I don't consider this a major reform. It's not as progressive as New York City or Washington, D.C., but it's a beginning. And it for the first time, has kind of a two-tiered system so that owner-occupants have a little more help than other property owners.
Does the threshold move from $250
to $750?
To $750. I also noted that the city appointed an ombudsman to sort of work these.
Yes, which is really great.
What would the ombudsman do?
Oh, my gosh. There are so many difficulties understanding the system. There are people who owe water bills. When they have leaks in their houses, their water bills are $5,000. They don't know what to do. They don't understand how to redeem. I mean, there's a lot of confusion.
Just today, speaking of the water bills, the Sun has a story saying that the city is sending turnoff notices to 25,000 delinquent water customers, giving them 10 days to pay long overdue bills or face the loss of water service. Now, water bills can also lead to loss of your property, right?
Absolutely. Right now, if your water bill is as low as $350, you can lose it to tax sale. And I recommended that water bills not even be part of the tax sale process. You can't lose your house in New York City or Washington, D.C. for unpaid water bill, for example. But maybe they'll do that next year.
In speaking of New York and D.C., where are they on arrears, delinquent taxes? What's their threshold?
New York City is, I believe, $1,000, but your taxes can be delinquent for 3 years. Washington, D.C., I think it's $2,500. They just passed a law.
Okay.
And they also have a lot of other really great help for homeowners. New York City, for example, exempts from tax sale senior citizens, military veterans, and the disabled. And Maryland's law and Baltimore's law does not.
The key piece is moving the threshold from 250 to 750. Is there a chance that'll pass in Annapolis?
That is a very good chance. The identical bills in the House and the Senate have been approved by each chamber, and they've crossed over. And it looks very hopeful right now that it's going to pass. There's some other remedies in the law that give owner-occupants a little more time to redeem their properties and to get better information from the people who purchase them of how much they owe, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. And it seems that ombudsman could really play an important
role. Yeah, the ombudsman
here
is not part of the legislation.
No, I understand.
It's something the city's going to do.
The city did it on
Absolutely.
Its own in
Absolutely.
Responding to this.
Yes.
No, well, you must feel pretty good about this, Joan.
Well, I do feel pretty
You're getting
good
some results. A work group went to work on this.
Yes, right.
Excellent.
Right. And one last thing I wanted to say is that the 18% interest is a city law, not a state law. So now the city council has to step up to the plate and lower that interest rate. And I hope they do.
And set a limit on how much interest can be charged by the holder of a lien.
Right.
Okay. Joan Jacobson, who wrote the report in October 2014 for the Able Foundation on the city's tax sales, giving us a follow-up there. Thank you very much, Joan.
Thanks, Dan.
We turn now to Sarah Gantz, a reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal, who's here with the weekly midday business report from the BBJ. Sarah, nice to see you again.
You too, Dan.
A couple of stories you had I wanted to talk about. The first one, before we get into some of the other stories, powdered alcohol. I'm a little late coming to this party, but Palcohol, which is a new powdered alcohol. First of all, well, the state is taking a step to ban the sale of this, right?
Yes,
we'll get to that in a minute. But what is it? It's just like a margarita in a package or in a box? What is it?
So Palcohol is the brand. It's made by Lipsmark.
Oh, okay. That's not a generic. It actually has a capital P. Okay.
Yeah, it's the first powdered alcohol that we're aware of. Basically, it's like an alcoholic version of iced tea mix or lemonade mix. It comes in a little packet. It's a powdered substance. When you mix it with water or another liquid, it dissolves and turns into alcohol. It comes in flavors like margarita and rum.
Okay. So the federal government approved this product, right?
Yes.
But the states aren't so hot about it, including Maryland. So what's happened? What's the news regarding Palcohol in Maryland?
Sure. So just earlier this week, Comptroller Francho said that he reached a voluntary ban, what's called a voluntary ban, with the state's liquor distributors in Maryland. All liquor stores and basically any retailer of liquor has to get it through one of these distributors. Through a wholesaler, yeah. Mm-hmm. So they've all banded together and said, we think this is a terrible idea. We don't want this in stores in Maryland. We've agreed that we're not going to stock it. So it's a voluntary ban because they've agreed to do it. It's enforceable under existing regulations.
Ah, this is interesting. So Peter Franchot, the state controller, thinks he can get a voluntary agreement by everybody not to sell it here.
He has reached the voluntary agreement.
He has that agreement.
They have agreed.
Oh, okay.
Right. So it's illegal in Maryland for a liquor store to go buy alcohol to stock its shelves from another state. So it has to buy it through these wholesalers who have agreed that they're not going to have it available.
That's very interesting. The General Assembly's underway, but there's no need, according to Franchot, no need for a new law.
He says that this ban is, as he put it, airtight, but he does support the legislation that's underway. It's been described as complementary, not competing with each other.
And Sarah, other states have moved to ban the sale of alcohol, huh?
Yeah, a number of states. South Carolina, Virginia, a few others. And there are many, many more, I think somewhere around 22 or so, that are considering bans.
If you don't mind me asking, like, what is the concern? The concern that it's just easy for kids to get a hold of it? It's easier to distribute, to conceal, to... What's the concern?
All of the above. There are a lot of concerns about it. And I think a lot of the concerns are stemming from the fact that it's not actually available yet. It doesn't go on sale until this summer. The company will start distributing it. People are worried that it's going to be especially appealing to teenagers. Would you go for a glass of rum, or would you buy a packet to make
it?
Teenagers who are more interested in experimentation might overindulge. It might be easier for them to make a very potent drink by mixing more than the recommended amount, or they could try other ways to ingest it, like mixing it in food or even snorting it. Palcohol's maker rejects all of these claims and says that their product's no more dangerous or accessible than any other alcohol. But still, there are a lot of health experts who are very concerned about it.
Sarah Gantz, reporter for the Baltimore Business Journal. She covers healthcare, higher education, biotech, technology, all of that. Yet another interesting story this week about millennials and healthcare. And we're coming up on our break, so you can stay a few minutes after the break because there are a couple other stories we wanted to talk about. This is interesting because millennials got this rap, deserved or not, as we were talking about the Affordable Care Act, the rollout of that. And the question was whether the young invincibles would even bother to sign up for health insurance that they didn't think they needed. So you have a report here from PNC Healthcare. That's PNC as in PNC?
It's their health policy research branch.
All right. Why don't we hold this till after the break?
Sure.
Why don't we do that? Because it turns out that maybe millennials are getting a bad rap when it comes to how they feel about themselves and health insurance. Sarah
That's
Gantz
right.
from the Baltimore Business Journal. More with Sarah in just a minute. Our conversation will continue then. But first, a quick break as we try to raise the money it takes to bring you the news and talk programming you hear on WIPR. And welcome back to Midday Friday. Dan Rodericks here with Sarah Gantz from the Baltimore Business Journal. Millennials with their invincible attitudes about seeing a doctor get a bad rap when it comes to healthcare, it turns out. At least if you go by a survey of some 5,000 American adults aged 21 and older in a survey conducted by PNC Healthcare. So what did that survey show, Sarah? They actually signed up for healthcare. They actually got the information they needed and... Did what they were supposed to do?
Well, the survey was more about how different age groups handle financial management of healthcare. So it showed things about preferences of where they like to get healthcare, how they do their research, and what kind of advanced legwork they're doing.
But they actually do research in advanced legwork, and they actually signed up for health insurance.
Yeah. So one of the points that I thought was most interesting was that 40% of millennials, so that's the age group between, you know, say 21 and 32, I guess, 40% asked for a cost estimate in advance of having a procedure. It's pretty good, considering that the survey found that
how many
only,
people do that?
Well, I'll tell you, only 18% of seniors, that's 72 and older, and 21% of baby boomers, so that's the sort of 50s, 60s, 70 range, asked for a cost estimate. So millennials
ask
were
a doctor,
more likely
say, how much
to
is
ask
it,
for a cost estimate.
How much is this going to cost me?
Yeah. Whether they got it, that's a different story, but they asked.
I want you to go get a lung scan. What's that going to cost me, doc? I don't think I've ever done that.
I have.
You're a millennial.
There you go.
Yeah, I'm one of those baby boomer guys. Okay, so millennials actually do ask, at least 40% of them, which is impressive. and they do their research online. It says that they actually, if they got a symptom or something like that.
Yeah.
Right?
So the survey asked how they researched in advance of signing up for healthcare during their open enrollment period, and about half said that they go online. They look online for information about their insurance plan, whereas older survey respondents were more likely to rely on pamphlets from the insurance company or a representative of the insurance company. Millennials were also more likely to seek out peer reviews through sites like Yelp and HealthGrades.
Have you ever used Yelp personally for HealthGrades?
For healthcare? No, yeah. I have not used Yelp.
Interesting idea. Also, they like peer reviews, and they like to multitask. I thought this was interesting. So wait a minute. What has multitasking got to do with healthcare when it comes to millennials? What do you mean?
Well, it means that you can pick up everything you might need at your grocery store or your pharmacy while also getting checked up. About 34% said that they would prefer to go see a doctor at what's called a retail or clinic space.
Oh, like CVS has now.
Compared to going to a doctor's office.
Yeah. CVS has a...
Yeah, like MinuteClinic.
MinuteClinic, mm-hmm. Yeah. I think Rite Aid started something like that, too. So that's what they would like, because while they're there, they can pick up some Yoo-hoo.
I imagine
they could do some milk,
it.
Right?
Yeah, I imagine convenience is part of it, whereas, you know, older survey respondents were more likely to seek out a private doctor's office to go to.
The upshot of this is that the millennials that did get this bad rap about, you know, there was a concern about whether they were going to bother even sign up for Obamacare, right?
Right.
That a lot of them did. And they take healthcare seriously.
They do. It's not totally unwarranted, though. The survey did also find that when it comes to delaying care, millennials were much more likely to delay care because of cost. 54% said that they would put off a procedure because it was too expensive, whereas older survey respondents were more likely to just go ahead and do it.
That's very interesting. They actually 40% of them ask for a cost estimate before undergoing treatment.
That's a new thing.
So, Sarah, thank you very much for that. You can find Sarah's stories in the Baltimore Business Journal as bizjournals.com/Baltimore. And the print version of the BBJ is out today. What's the cover story?
Our cover story today is a focus on Howard County. It's a really exciting feature that we have by our real estate reporter, Kevin Litton. He took a closer look at Columbia, the developer who is in charge of Merriweather, the concert venue, is looking to create a more central downtown area for Columbia. A lot of people find Columbia to be very suburban, I guess,
yeah,
is a good way to put it.
Dull after hours, right? After,
you said it, not me.
After people. Well, and there's this idea that you can create a real downtown and a vibrant downtown life in Columbia, right?
Right, yeah. I think the idea is to try to attract more young people. Baltimore is seeing a lot more growth in its millennial population. I think Columbia is looking to try to take some of that.
That's the cover story of this week's BBJ. Sarah, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you, Dan.
We're going to turn now to sports. The University of Maryland women's basketball team headed for... Well, they're in March Madness, but headed into the Sweet 16 tomorrow, 4:30 p.m. out in Spokane, Washington. They're going up against Duke. We wanted to speak with Sports at Large commentator about this, Milton Kent. Milton, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
I know what your pleasure is. You like to watch women play basketball, especially Terps women. You covered them when you were with the Baltimore Sun in the national championship 2006.
Mm-hmm.
So how's this team look to you?
This team looks like a really good team. It surprised. Well, it shouldn't come as a surprise to a lot of people that they are good. They only really lost one player from last year's Final Four team. Now, albeit that player was the all-time leading scorer and rebounder in the history of the program, Alyssa Thomas. But they returned all the crucial players, all the other crucial players, and they moved to a conference where. And this is, you know, a lot of people really haven't picked up on this. They were the preseason favorite to win the Big Ten. What I think is interesting for a lot of people, who don't follow women's basketball or basketball in general, this is an ACC team. This roster has a lot of athleticism, a lot of speed, and it's primed to do well in this particular conference, the Big Ten, which has, more size and bulk. Five ACC teams are in the Sweet 16. And if Maryland were still in the Big Ten, it would be, we're still in the ACC, it would be six. So you know, they've got something of, they come into this with something of an advantage. And
But Saturday they're playing another ACC team, right?
Right. Yeah. And so I think if somebody had a sense of humor that Duke would be the opponent, you know, the way things match up, because these have been everybody in this area has grown to hate Duke. And you know, the men's coach, Mike Krzyzewski, has basically vowed that he'll never play Maryland now that they're out of the ACC. So a lot of folks are going to get a chance to take out their hatred on Duke Saturday afternoon.
Let's talk about the team. I got to see the Princeton game. Princeton game Monday night or Sunday?
Yeah, that would be Monday night.
Yeah, Monday night.
Yeah.
Now, the Tigers came into that game 31-0, and that was a convincing win by Maryland, led by Lauren Mincy and the point guard Lexi Brown.
Yes.
Tell us about those two women.
Lauren Mincy is a real interesting story. We'll start with her because she's a senior. She's a fifth-year senior. And basically, you could call this kid Job because every possible thing that could happen to a kid has happened to her. She's torn her knee, I think, in both ligaments in both knees and has missed time. And she hung in there. When she came in, I remember when she came into College Park, she came in with a lot of people thought she was going to be a terrific player, and things just didn't quite work out. But over the years, she's become sort of like a glue player, if you will. She had a big numbers Monday night against Princeton. I think it's a career, either a season high or career high. The real catalyst on this team, though, is the point guard, Lexi Brown. She's a sophomore. She's the daughter, for those of you who are NBA fans, her father is Dee Brown, who played for the Boston Celtics, and won a slam dunk competition. The guy's like 5'10", and he won a slam dunk competition, and the big thing he did, I think he won it blindfolded. This kid, she's got lots of moxie, as they say. She was probably one of the top freshmen in the country last year, and she's matured. You know, she might take a questionable shot here and there, but otherwise she's a real solid ball player. And, you know, she and Lauren Mincy and a couple other kids, Brianna Jones is a center, and they have another sort of guard forward named Shatori Walker-Kimbrough. All four of them are averaging in double figures. So even if one of them has a bad night, the other three and the rest of the club will pick them up.
Maryland will be playing in Spokane, Washington. As you said, they'll be playing Duke, former Atlantic Coast Conference arch rival Duke, fourth seeded in this tournament. So what do we look for this weekend?
Duke is very strong up front. They've got a kid named Elizabeth Williams, who's at least a two-time ACC Player of the Year. She's 6'3", 6'4". She might be the first player chosen in the WNBA draft. She's a center. She can shoot with either hand, solid ball player. And last year she lit Maryland up. She's always played well against Maryland. They also have a kid named Rebecca Greenwell, who's a dynamite 3-point shooter who comes off of screens. She hit a shot the other day to win their game from about 30 feet away from the basket. So they're going to present a challenge, particularly up front. Now, where Maryland has a very distinct advantage is in the backcourt. They've got their backcourt is probably one of the best in the country. Duke, on the other hand, has lost two prime guards this year, one to injury and one who transferred. So I think my guess is whoever controls the tempo is going to win this game. In other words, I think Maryland's probably going to want to speed things up. And Duke's going to want to slow things down. And whoever's able to impose their will on the other one will probably win.
And I just want to get your guess here. If Maryland were to make it to the championship game, who do you think their opponent would be coming from the other side of the bracket?
Well, in order to get to the championship game, they'd have to go through Connecticut first because they're on the same side of the bracket as Connecticut.
Yeah.
And
So let's assume that happens.
Okay.
So who would you see there?
My guess would be they play South Carolina, and that would be a great battle between South Carolina, whose coach is Dawn Staley, who's a wonderful story. She went to Virginia, like three-time National Player of the Year, and now is like an accomplished coach and has built South Carolina into a program. If they get through Connecticut, they'd have to, and that's not an insignificant thing.
I know. But I
do think they have a chance, if only because I think Brenda won't let them be afraid of Connecticut. Most of facing Connecticut, the biggest challenge to facing them is the mental side.
Mm-hmm.
Because they will. Connecticut plays the way the New England Patriots play football. Once they have their foot on your throat, they don't let up. They stomp you.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can stay with them, I think if you can keep the game close, give them a challenge, it'll be interesting to see how they respond down the stretch.
Well, let's hope the Terps get there at least.
We'll see.
Milton Kent, thanks very much.
My pleasure, Dan.
Milton Kent, Sports at Large commentator for WYPR. Thank you. And before we close out this first hour today, I want to pass condolences on to the family and friends of Bill Tuohy, William J. Bill Tuohy, former spokesman for the Baltimore County Police Department, who was the face of the department for many years. He died Thursday. As the Baltimore Sun noted in its obituary, Mr. Tuohy, a former radio reporter, appeared widely in the broadcast and print media during the two-week crime spree of Joseph Palczynski that gripped this region back in the year 2000, in March of 2000. Longtime listeners of this station will remember when this station, as WJHU, had an evening newscast that Bill anchored. Later, when he was hired by the Baltimore County Police Department to be its spokesman, it was a well-received appointment. Reporters knew that one of our own, who understood how the press functioned, would be in charge of disseminating information about crime and police activities. Bill was a wonderful guy. I'm sorry to see him hear of his death. He was fair, prompt, always professional, with a sense of humor much needed in that business and now much missed. Stay tuned. We got another hour of Midday coming up for you, and we have pizza for our guests today from Joe Squared Pizza. We thank them again for providing lunch for our guests. Another hour of Midday in just a moment.